Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be hearing from Big Brothers Big Sisters, and we'll also be hearing about an a cappella Cuban music concert. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kathleen Dudley and Don Hamilton. They're with a group called Drilling Mora County. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So we are here to talk about the issue called hydraulic fracturing or fracking. What is hydraulic fracturing?
Hydraulic fracturing is a process that the oil and gas industry is using to, mostly with natural gas, I guess they're doing it some with oil, but to release trapped gas because, for example, in the Las Vegas Basin where we are, the natural gas, the methane gas, is in a shale bed. And so it's not like you think there's a big pocket of gas. It's trapped in tiny little pockets throughout the bed of shale. So as the shale layered down and the organisms broke down, the gas is trapped in tiny little pockets. So you can't just drill down there and have it released. So what they have to do is fracture that shale bed in order to release the gas. So, you know, it sounds innocuous enough,
It sounds pretty heavy duty.
Well, it is heavy duty, and that's the problem. And so what they do actually is they drill down vertically, and then they drill out horizontally, like, you know, a mile or two, and they then use hydraulic pressure to force a fluid through these pipes, and it slams at different sections in the pipe and fractures the rock. And one of the problems that can cause is that can damage other strata that are above or below it. And so the methane gas that can then get released into the aquifer along with the other organic chemicals and hydrocarbons that are in there, such as benzenes and toluenes and so forth. But the other problem is that in the fracturing fluids or the fracking fluids, they use millions of gallons of water in each fracking process. And with every million gallons, they've got about 5,000 gallons of toxic chemicals that they use in there to lubricate, to keep the cracks open when they fractured them. They use radioactive sand that they can track with instruments and so forth. So they're injecting these 5,000 gallons of toxic fluids into the earth, and they recover a certain percentage of them, but the rest of it stays down there, and that also contaminates. And so what's happened in areas like Wyoming and Colorado and western Colorado around Rifle and so forth, there have been a lot of cases where these fracturing fluids have gotten into drinking water and into the water that people use in their homes. And in one case, for example, they knew about it. The state agency that oversees it in Colorado advised the woman not to drink the water, but she continued to use showers and bathe and everything else. And she became quite ill with a rare thyroid cancer that was then known to come from that particular ingredient in the fracking fluid. So,
although I would imagine that the people who made the fracking fluids would not cop to the cause and effect.
They don't exactly cop to it, but they did agree to provide drinking water, and they do that in a lot of places. So they know that they've damaged it, but they're dancing as much as possible. One of the reasons that they don't cop to it is because in the United States anywhere other than what we've done, they don't have pre-drilling water samples. And so you can go and you can find some weird, you know, fluorobenzene compound or something, and the gas company says, well, that was probably in your water beforehand. You can't prove that it was from us. And if they don't have baseline water samples, you can't prove it. And that's the problem.
So in Mora County, you are actually taking baseline water samples to see in your unfracked, undrilled aquifers what the composition of the water is.
Yes. This last December, we brought in a certified water sampler, and he took water samples based upon a protocol that we had put together with the help of various labs and citizen groups and scientists and environmental engineers around the country. And we sampled six community water wells, and then we did seven or eight, actually, private wells from Watros area all the way to the north of the Las Vegas Basin, and then from east to west, from Ocotay all the way over to Wagon Mound. And in taking these samples, we went to existing wells. Some were as shallow as 40 feet, and some were as deep as 300 feet.
So when you get these samples, do they become then official data that, if necessary, can be used in a court of law at some point?
Yes, and so we have very specific chemicals that were tested for, and we tested for those that would show up in almost all hydraulic fracturing formulas. There were some rather non-toxic chemicals, but those were considered markers, certain surfactants that tend to be in most of the hydraulic fluids. And so when we end up with these tests, then we also write up a series of documents that industry requires as well, so that that becomes a defensible set of documents along with our tests that have come from a certified drinking water well lab in the state of New Mexico. And that becomes our packet. So if industry was to come and drill, then we would be able to take that documentation to court and say, well, we had no benzene in this water, we had no methane in this water, we had no arsenic, we had no cadmium, and all of those ingredients are showing up in our water now that you have done hydraulic fracturing and drilling on this land here.
Now, the purpose of that, supposing that there is drilling in Mora County, is to recover damages should there be actual contamination?
That's one purpose. I mean, the other purpose, we're hoping that by having this data in place that the drilling companies will, A, think twice if there's not, maybe if there's not a lot amount of hydrocarbon in there, which we suspect there's not, that the drillers may not choose to come here because they know that they can't do it, and not, if they cause problems, they will get caught. And B, that if they do it, they're going to have to be a lot more careful than maybe they have been otherwise. And one other comment just about the sampling process is we also used a certified sampler who is certified by the state to come and sample it. We didn't just take the samples ourselves,
right?
But we had a professional sampler do that as well.
So that was something for which you had to raise money.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We received a grant from the McCune Foundation. We were very grateful to them because without that, we would not have been able to afford to do this. We worked with Wes Wilson, who is a retired EPA, Environmental Protection Agency environmental engineer. And he has been following this because he was the whistleblower on the EPA in 2004. The EPA in 2004 had done a hydraulic fracturing study, and it became a cover-up. While in their actual study, they found that when you inject these fluids into the earth, that they will actually contaminate the waterways. And when he read the final results of their study, he took that to Congress and took protection under the whistleblower status. Well, Wes has been helping us, and one of the things that he told us as I was approaching him about the work that we were going to be doing with the baseline, and he said, you're the first county in the entire country who will be putting baseline water well testing in place. Now, when we decided to do this, we didn't think that what we were doing was anything unusual. We just thought that it was something, again, proactive. And so, as Don is saying, if we can perhaps keep industry out because we will now have defensible data, that's something that all communities, all counties could work toward doing.
Have you seen any other counties in New Mexico doing the same thing?
No, actually I haven't. There are some counties up in, or communities up in Colorado. We have been contacted by people in Nova Scotia, Canada, by a group in South Africa, and some folks in New York, the state of New York, but very few people have actually contacted us based upon these results, even though this information has been taken by the Associated Press and it's been in newspapers.
Now, this is a completely citizen-led effort.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
When we talk about hydraulic fracturing, and by the way, we're talking with Kathleen Dudley and Don Hamilton from Drilling Mora County, when we talk about fracturing, the way you're describing it, there are, I mean, there's one great benefit, which is you get gas, which is what gas companies are looking for, and we heat our houses and so on. We use energy. On the negative side is a huge amount of water use in a town or community or a state like New Mexico where there's not a whole lot of extra water. Water potentially becomes toxic. Radioactive sand, I don't know how big a problem that is or what effect that has or could have. Also, when you destroy that much shale, are there geological problems that do or can result?
Well, we're reading reports right now in Arkansas of massive numbers of earthquakes, and the earthquakes beginning recently simultaneously with the hydraulic fracturing. And an area that has had some history of earthquakes, but the coincidence of the earthquake activity recently with the hydraulic fracturing activity certainly leads one to wonder. We've also seen this in Texas. There have been many reports of earthquake activity around gas fields.
Have geologists weighed in on this one way or the other?
Well, of course, there's always two sides of the story. There are geologists who believe that it's related to natural gas drilling, and there are those that I believe are on the dole with the natural gas companies.
But we have spoken, Andrew Feldman, for example, up at Luna Community College in Las Vegas, is a geologist, and he certainly, I mean, he's not an expert, but he considers it quite plausible, you know, in looking at it. He at first apparently was somewhat open to the gas drilling, but the more he's talked with another member of Drilling Mora County, that he's, and as Andrew looked into it, Dr. Feldman has found that there are a lot of these problems that we've talked about. He's particularly concerned about the water because he said there's absolutely no way that there's enough water, but he also has weighed in on the potential geologic effect and thinks that it's certainly plausible.
When a gas company comes in to do gas extraction using hydraulic fracturing, are they required to pay the municipality for the water that they use?
When the gas companies come in, what they have done by this point, they have gotten a permit from the Oil Conservation Division here in Santa Fe. And in the case of Mora County, they would have had to have gotten a permit to drill from on the county level. Other than that, their experience or their relationship on the private owner's land has to do with their lease terms that they have on paper and recorded with in the courthouse with that private landowner. We've looked at the leases that are currently in the Mora County clerk's office. With the exception of one of those leases, the property owners have leased for 10 years all their water rights along with their mineral leases. So I think that most of those people are unaware that they have leased away their water rights, but that means that the gas company who's drilling can take all the water on that property that's underground.
And of course that doesn't, as we know, the underground aquifer underneath, say, John Smith's property doesn't stop at his border.
Right.
And so, you know, if they can take, basically they can drain the aquifers.
There is a great problem that was very well outlined in a documentary film called Split Estate, in which you might own the surface of your land, but you don't own the mineral rights underneath it. So in theory, anybody can come in who's got a permit and go, 10 feet away from your house and drill a hole for the next 10 years. Is that true?
Well, my understanding is they can't be any closer than the height of the derrick. So
twice the height.
Approximately 150 to 200 feet to your house.
Okay. Which still isn't very far.
Not when you consider that the noxious chemicals are spewing into the air and the sound of the compressors and the workmen there. So the interference from that standpoint is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. Have you visited people and places where a private landowner suddenly has a drilling rig on their land?
We haven't visited specifically. We've certainly seen it in the documentaries, but we've communicated quite a lot with Gilbert Armenta and Chris Velasquez of San Juan County, who were interviewed, or Gilbert was interviewed in Split Estate. You can hear Chris's voice in Split Estate, but we've communicated with them quite a bit. We've had them here several times to our house, and they've spoken and so forth. And, yeah, they're in that situation where they have gas rigs right outside the door, and it's horrendous. They both just say absolutely do not let them in if there's any way.
Another issue is that the companies who do the hydraulic fracturing will not divulge, in many cases, what's in the fracking fluids in the first place because they call it proprietary.
Yes, and of course, we know that as long as they hold all of the information, it will be impossible for citizens or healthcare professionals or local government agencies to be able to respond in any protective way. There are some charges, however, in Texas with the EPA against a drilling company for contaminating of a couple of water wells on private land. And that particular challenge, again, is asserting that the very chemicals that the natural gas companies are using in their hydraulic fracturing are being found in these private wells. But of course, the oil companies are saying that it couldn't possibly be that, and they're challenging them again based upon the fact that they do not have any baseline water well testing prior to the gas wells being drilled. Now, as long as the companies are not forced to divulge their chemicals, then very little gets done. So again, the baseline is very important. But on the part of the EPA, they are doing some studies now, and they are trying to push industry, as are a number of different senators, to force industry to disclose their chemicals. But industry plays tricks. What they do is they don't produce their CAS numbers. So
what are CAS?
CAS numbers are basically the marker to the specific chemical so that you can track it. Like it's like a library log, where only it's like a medical log, and you can actually track it based upon a specific number. And without a specific number, since industry can give you 25 synonyms for a specific chemical, then you can be chasing the tail of that donkey for hours and hours or months and months and never right. come up with the final result.
What kinds of laws are there on a national level, on a state level, on county, on municipal levels to protect citizens, to protect groundwater?
Well, the laws, I mean, that's another issue. There are some certainly national levels, like the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act. But thanks to the Halliburton loophole that the Bush-Cheney administration put in, those don't apply to the drilling companies. They don't apply to the gas extraction companies. So there are efforts being made to bring them back in line under that. Otherwise, there are, at some level in the state, the State Environment Department has some jurisdiction. The Oil Conservation Division has some jurisdiction over the water quality here in New Mexico, but it's pretty minimal.
If I could add to that, OCD does have...
OCD.
Oil Conservation Division, the state, does have responsibility for the groundwater. And but that comes after the their responsibility to bring up as much, make sure that as much of the resource that is underground is brought up as possible. So even the environment comes second to our state oversight. On the county level, it depends upon what kind of ordinances are in place. In Mora County, we have a very strict ordinance, and that ordinance says that any industry that pollutes the air, the water, takes too much of our water, and or causes ill health is a prohibited industry. So our ordinance for the county has really not been tested. This will really test this ordinance. And of course,
you're hoping it will never be tested, of
course.
Well,
of course. But a lot of times what happens in order to bring out the support by the people or even the local government officials is something has to be tested. You know, Drilling Mora County has been doing proactive educational work and also our proactive work with the baseline water well testing. But until you're really under attack, truly under attack, you don't get that true polarization or the outpouring of concern and the action on the part of the county people. So if this does end up coming right into our county, I think that our ordinance is something that really could stand strongly.
So this leads into a question which is very interesting, which is something called community rights-based ordinances. So you've got ordinances in places like Mora County, which I guess is really extraordinarily forward-looking, thinking about the needs and rights of the people there, and also about the traditions of the people there. I mean, give us a sense of Mora County as a place.
Well, Mora County, of course, is a sort of quintessential northern New Mexico county. It's been historically agricultural for quite a long time. There's still that history. There's still a connection to the land and the people, even though at this time there's not as much agriculture there as there certainly used to be. But the Planning and Zoning Commission and the County Commission in the early 1990s decided to revamp their ordinances based upon some issues with potential subdivisions there. And what they did is they actually surveyed the people to find out what the people of the county wanted. And the people of the county overwhelmingly wanted to protect their water, they wanted to protect agriculture, they wanted to protect those traditions and cultures. And the outlet of that was basically the DGS and the land use plan that's
DGS.
In the county. The development guidance system for the county, that ordinance that Kathleen mentioned that says that extractive industries or that polluting industries are prohibited. So it's the guidance system for development within the county, and then the land use plan within the county. And so all that came sort of cathonically out of the people. It's the will of the people who came through. Since then, in the last administration, prior to the one that's in now, they haven't been willing to poll the people on what the people wanted in terms of potential oil and gas drilling and so forth. But historically, that it has come out of that. So that's, you know, the county is very agriculture, very land-based, cathonic sort of a culture.
Cathonic.
Cathonic is of the earth. It's like a culture that actually grows out of the earth to where it lives, like an aboriginal culture.
Right. So have ordinance such as this been tested when they come in conflict with either the mighty power of oil and gas or indeed state laws that are different from the ordinances?
Well, the ordinance that's in place right now would be construed as a regulatory ordinance. In other words, in order for the oil companies to come in, they would have to be permitted. So it's called a permissible ordinance. And this particular ordinance, however, is probably one of the most stringent, most strict ordinances in the country, next to one in Maine. Now, the new Santa Fe oil and gas ordinance is a regulatory ordinance. What we're talking about with the community rights-based ordinance is a slightly different type of ordinance, because in essence what it does is it stands up for human rights, the right to clean water, the right to clean air, the right to our safety, and the right to our health, which predate the Constitution. Now, the oil industry says we have the right to take our resources, our minerals, by the Constitution. But the human rights predate the Constitution.
What do you mean they predate?
Well, we're essentially born with the right to clean water, clean air, our health, our safety. We're literally born as human beings with those rights. And it's only being...
So certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness kind of thing.
Exactly.
Which are not exactly codified. I mean, the Declaration of Independence is a nice thing, but it's not law.
Well, actually, the Constitution is law, and you'll find those in the Constitution as well. And you'll see them in state statutes, and you'll see that every single elected official takes an oath of office, and within that oath of office, they agree to protect the health, welfare, and safety of the citizens who have elected them into office. And they have police powers, which give them the right to protect those rights of the citizens. It's just that in a regulatory structure, such as the laws that are in place now, those rights are not a part of that process. And what we're saying is, let us exercise our democratic process of having our rights protected. So a community rights-based ordinance actually prohibits any industry from harming those human rights. And what we're looking at is pushing the envelope. This is outside of the box. This is outside of the regulatory structure, which industry and our state and local governments are in compliance together, working to basically create windows of opportunity for industry. They have nothing to do with protecting the actual rights of the humans. So this human rights community-based ordinance is something that 120 communities across the country, as well as Ecuador and Bolivia, have put into place. Some have been challenged, and others are firmly in place and are holding industry out.
And that becomes a culture in itself when you start to have laws that are created by a community for the benefit of that community. That becomes a way of life of the citizens.
Exactly. And if I could sort of add, you know, a little clarification, is that the regulatory system is sort of what I call a top-down system. And in essence, it says, the law says that if the state regulates oil and gas, then the county and the municipality cannot regulate oil and gas because the state preempts that right. And so in that sense, the regulatory ordinances enacted by counties are at risk because the state says, well, we already have an oil conservation division that regulates that. You cannot also regulate it to more strict ways than we do. However, these community rights-based ordinances are saying that, no, the Constitution actually says that the law comes of the people. The Declaration of Independence says that, the state constitution. And these ordinances are saying, no, it's a bottom-up type of a system, in which means that the people have the right for self-governance, that we in Mora County have the right to decide what we want from Mora County, and that the state and the federal government does not have the right to come in and say, it doesn't matter what you want in your county, we are saying that it's okay for the oil companies to come and drill, therefore you have to come in and drill. So it is, you're right, it's a culture change, and it's a complete change from recognizing a top-down system to saying, no, the law actually, as it says in the Constitution, rests in and derives from the people. And it's an exercising of that fact. And if I could say one more thing, what everybody says is that they have the oil companies have the right to these hydrocarbons that are under the ground, and that it's a taking if we prohibit them because it takes their private property. However, that regulatory structure never takes into place the taking of my clean water and my health and all that. And what these ordinances are doing is simply putting that balance into the picture and saying, there may be a taking if our laws that say that we have the right to clean water prohibit you from taking your oil if you can't do it cleanly, but there is the other side of that, the other taking that will occur if we're not protected. You know, if my neighbor goes and drills and he depletes my well and he contaminates my well, you have to factor that in. And at this point, they have refused to factor that in. And that's what these laws do.
Don Hamilton and Kathleen Dudley are with Drilling Mora County. For more information, you can go to their website, drillingmoracounty.blogspot.com. And you can also write to them at drillingmoracounty@gmail.com. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you much, Mary Charlotte.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Ron Roybal. He is the events coordinator with Big Brothers Big Sisters, and we are here just before the 28th annual Bowl for Kids' Sake. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this has been going on a long time. What's the bowling event about?
Bowling event, this is our target number one event that we have for fundraising and drawing awareness for Big Brothers Big Sisters. We are on our 28th annual this year. And what we do is we get people to form teams of five. They go out and collect pledges and help support the agency to do what we do. And that's providing a mentor for a child who needs and wants one of them. So we ask people to help us continue keeping our doors open, helping our community, helping us to draw awareness in to become Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and also to help fund the area. So people form teams of five and go through their friends and family and ask for pledges. And we ask each person to collect at least $100 minimum each, and which is a total of $500 for the whole team. It costs on average about $1,500 a year to support a little in our program and support the big and little for 1 year, which includes background checks and support contact through the whole year. So with three teams, we could then support three Bowl for Kids Day teams. We could support one match for the whole year if the team does a minimum 500 each.
And many of them do more.
Oh, many, many more. We had a few people who have raised the thousands level of getting people to help pledge in their team efforts. So on average, we usually get about $900 per team on average when we average it all out from last year's event.
And it's a lot of fun.
It's a great time. We don't party much at Big Brothers Big Sisters, but this is one event where we go out and the event itself is a celebratory event. It's really, we always say, it doesn't matter about your bowling skills so much, about going and having a good time.
So it's not about how many pins you knock down.
Nowhere near that shape or form. It's awareness building and fun building for us. And we turned off our event here in the area is at Pewaukee, Strike Gold Lanes in Pewaukee. Beautiful facility. The staff there are just so amazing to us, and the facility itself is beautiful. We turned down all the lights, put on the strobe lights, turned on some great fun disco 70s music, and just have a great time for those two bowls. Each team gets a bowl for two games, and it's usually about a two-hour segment that everybody gets to have, and we just have a great time bowling and having a great time.
And bowling, ladies and gentlemen, I haven't bowled for quite a while, but it's so much fun. And when you haven't bowled, even if you've only bowled when you were a kid, and then you go out there again, what I find is my first ball is always a strike, and then I can never recreate it.
Yeah, we do have some folks who come and just tear it up with their strikes and get turkeys. And we have some folks who also are throwing gutter balls and asking if they can get the bumpers up. But it's a really great time. It's so much fun to be out there enjoying the community and seeing how they help support us.
So people have several weeks left to form teams and get sponsors. They can register with Big Brothers Big Sisters, and we'll give more information about that at the end. So Big Brothers Big Sisters, I mean, we have you guys on the air just about every year, but what's it all about? You are a big brother yourself, and you've been a big brother for a long time.
I've been a big brother since 1993, myself. When I first moved to Santa Fe, I wanted to figure out what I could do to help my community. And so I was interested in Big Brothers Big Sisters, got enrolled, got interviewed, and since then I've had three different littles. There was a period about 4 or 5 years where I did take off, so it hasn't been a full time. But I've had three different littles in my life right now. Me and my little Malachi have been together it's been about 5 years. Him and I've been together, and we just have an awesome relationship together.
So you always have little brothers. There seems to be a shortage of big brothers. There are more available big sisters, and there's a lot of little boys who are waiting for a mentor, male figure in their lives.
That's right. We right now have about, and at our agency in Northern New Mexico, we have about 70 little boys who are waiting to get a big brother in their life. We are aggressive in trying to recruit men to become a bigs in our program, but the reality is that more women tend to be the type who want to volunteer and help out, and so we match our little girls or little sisters very rapidly because they don't stay on the waiting list for long. We do have some big sisters who would want to be matched with a little brother, and if that's what the family feels and needs, then we will go ahead and match a big sister to a little brother, but we never do the opposite.
Right. Now, what are some of the rewards that you've had as a big brother?
Oh, gosh, there's many. But one thing that I always tell people is you get to become a kid again. You get to go and have fun and do things that you may not have gone and done normally.
Like bowling.
We monster trucks. Him and I do the monster trucks every time when they come around town. We go swimming together. We'll go hiking. We'll just watch a 3D movie. Sometimes just those, you know, those great 3D animation movies that come out, and go on doing things that I may not go play video games. That's something that's not part of my everyday activity, but something he enjoys. We go do some stuff like that. So we end up getting activities that bring out the child in me, and I get a lot more out of it than I think he even knows himself. But it's a two-way street, definitely, that we share with each other, and I get a lot out of it.
So the young people that you had in, well, almost 20 years ago, 1993, you started. Have you kept in touch?
I sure have. My first little is, he's about 20, 23 right now. And we just, this past year, reconnected. He was moved to Hawaii, and it had been a few years since I've seen him. And ran into him his mother about a few months ago, and it turned out that he had, in Hawaii, got in a really bad car wreck and escaped death. But now his, he's in a wheelchair. He's handicapped. And when I ran into mom, I was so excited to finally meet up with her because I've been trying to find them. When I ran into her, she says, "Oh my gosh, have you heard about Frankie?" And I said, "No." And so she told me the story about him getting this car wreck in Hawaii and almost losing his life, and that his memory was just not quite exactly what it was, and that she wasn't sure if he would remember me. So I said, "Well, let's try it out. Let's just see," because it would be so helpful for him to jog his memory. So I called him up without him knowing who it was, and I gave him a few hints of who I was on the phone without telling him directly. And after a few hints, he just gasped out in this loudest, excited voice, "Ron!" That he knew who I was, and that was really, really emotional for me and for him as well, and his mom, that knowing that even though he was forgetting a lot of things that happened since the accident and of his life, that he was still was able to remember me. And we haven't been able to get together one-on-one, him and I. I've seen him with his mom a few times, but we have reconnected with him definitely. So it's a life-changing experience to be involved with somebody's life and knowing the greatest gift you can give to somebody is gift of your time. And I think that's what I've given to them, and they've given back to me.
And that time doesn't have to be expensive and doesn't even have to necessarily be out of the house. You can just order a pizza and stay home and have dinner and talk.
Exactly. We, in fact, advocate saying that please don't use this as a gift-giving and in a Santa Claus time at any shape or form. We want it to be the gift of your time. And it could be having dinner with you and your family. It could be going and watching a movie at your house, getting pizza, like you said, going to fishing, going to church, if that's your family, if the families are on the same wavelength on that. But it's always just hanging out with each other and doing things that you both normally would do anyway.
We're talking to Ron Roybal about Big Brothers Big Sisters. Why don't more men sign up to be big brothers?
You know, that's something it's really interesting. I think that most guys are just maybe afraid of what that entails and what they might want to do with the little and what they're going to be spending time with. We hope that more men will come through and say, "This is really something that I really want to do." But I know from my end, it's just been a fabulous experience for me, and please ask anybody to really look into it. It's really not that much time away from your family or time from your other things you may have going on. If you play softball, they could go to your softball game with you.
Big Brothers Big Sisters, we've had them on as long as I've been doing this show. They've been around for many years, and I have to say it's a very well-run organization. It's something they just do an excellent job, and they do a very efficient job, and they're very good at fundraising, and above all, they provide a service that really nobody else provides. And for people who don't have the parenting, let's say, that they need or the role models that they need, it is absolutely life-changing for all these kids. And the Bowl for Kids' Sake is the annual event. It starts on the 3rd of April.
April 3rd is our first event.
And there's several of them.
Mm-hmm.
The first three weekends of April.
Here in the Santa Fe northern part of the state, we have April 3rd, 9th, and 10th. And then in Las Vegas, we have one on May 15th. That one's a Wii Bowling, which is a really great event that we do since there's no bowling center there in Las Vegas.
You go out on the dirt?
Wii Bowling, that's the Nintendo Wii.
Wii Bowling?
Yeah, Wii Bowling, the Nintendo Wiis. We had about 9 Wiis last year set up in the ballroom at the Plaza Hotel, Historic Plaza Hotel, and made it look like into a little bowling center. And people just had a blast. We had one team that was full of older folks, and one lady had her walker, but she was able to stand in front of the TV and move her wrist and body to get the Wii to roll the ball out kind of in a way and it was just a fabulous event to see that community wrap itself around Big Brothers Big Sisters and Wii Bowling. And then we have one more event in Gallup, McKinley County, And actually, that's April 16th in McKinley County. That's part of our service area as well.
So how do people get in touch and register and find out more about it?
First, they could end up calling me. I'm the event coordinator for Big Brothers Big Sisters in Northern New Mexico. And our phone number is 505-983-8360. And what we do then is they could contact me. I get them mailed out to them or deliver them a team packet. So on that team packet, there will be five members that you'll be doing. The team captain would be the one in charge of the whole team. And then four other members. It could be their coworkers, their friends, their sorority friends, whatever they could get a team of five, including themselves, and start collecting pledges. Turn in their roster ahead of time so they can secure their day and time. On April 3rd, we have a 1 p.m. and a 3:30 p.m., and that's the State Employees Bowl. We've been real lucky this year to have our new governor and first gentleman to support the event, which we've had in the past with Bill Richardson and his wife. And then on the 9th and the 10th, actually on the 9th, we have a 10 a.m., 1 p.m., and a 3:30.
And they can find more about that if they go to the website.
Yeah. Our website is bbbsnorthernnm.org.
Ron Roybal, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. We'll see you at Bowl for Kids' Sake.
Thanks so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Ramon Calderon. He's a musician and music producer, and Solar Banner, who is also a music producer. And they've got a concert coming up Friday, the 4th of March. That's tomorrow. It's called Cuba Next Exit, and it's a cappella and scat Cuban music. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Bueno. Yeah, thank you.
So a cappella Cuban music, I mean, that's the kind of, we'll hear some of it in a minute, but that's basically music that often imitates the instruments of Cuban music, but it's all done with the voice and the hands. Yeah. Does this have a long history in Cuba?
Sí, ya desde 1700 a 1800, cuando en Cuba los españoles no dejaban tocar tambores.
Yeah, from the 1600s to the 1800s, when the Spanish did not allow the African people to play the drums. So the grandfathers and the fathers would transmit the African rhythms through the voice, with voice. And later on in the 1800s, in the 1900s, with the French influence, so then the music was also transmitted through not only by the voice, but with the piano and also with other instruments as well. And so even then, even though it was already being done in Cuba, when Bobby McFerrin came out in the 1980s, he then continued to influence musicians in Cuba to continue on in this genre of música con la boca.
Because Bobby McFerrin was so successful and so compelling in doing this a cappella music, which was incredibly wide-ranging.
Yeah, la única diferencia es que Bobby McFerrin, él estudió en la universidad y entonces estudió lo que es la música a cappella.
So, and of course, the difference is that Bobby McFerrin studied at the university and he basically studied música a cappella, which was, you know, choral. And was based more in harmony, where, you know, when we do música con la boca in Cuba, we're based more in rhythm and in the tambor.
Interesting. So this concert, Cuba Next Exit, you're calling it a musical event for the whole family. It's not just going to be you singing and doing rhythmic music, rhythmic Cuban music, a cappella, but also a kind of explanatory narrative about all of this.
Sí, nosotros vamos a combinar un poco.
Yeah, we're going to concentrate a little bit of the concert on how it all came about and how I subconsciously, when I was in Cuba, picked up this method of making música con la boca.
Y entonces, si vas a tocar una rumba...
Well, it's like, for instance, if I'm going to play a rumba, then I go into a little bit of the history of the rumba, but also into the instrumentation of the rumba. And every instrument has a different rhythm. And when you bring all of these instruments together, then what you have is the polyrhythm. So when I was a child, I had to learn each one by one, so that I could remember this. So that's what I want to be able to show the children in this concert, is that each instrument has its own rhythm, its own sound, and how each one is played singularly, and then how each one of those sounds by itself.
Por ejemplo, en la rumba hay una clave que hace. Hay un tambor salidor que hace. Hay otro que hace. Como mismo hace la voz, como mismo hace la mano. Mm-hmm. Así se aprende. Entonces, cuando todo se une, se hace la polirrítmica. Otra cosa más.
So, for instance, we have different ethnic groups that have come to Cuba, and each ethnic group brings its own form of music along with their culture and their languages.
And their own set of rhythms.
And their own set of rhythms.
You just gave a little example of some of the sounds you're going to make. As one person, you can show us and teach us each one of the polyrhythms, but can you do them all together at the same time?
Well, for instance, I can do at least three instruments at a time.
So as one person, you can simultaneously represent three instruments?
Three instruments at a time. But for instance, in a group like vocal sampling, where they do each one specifically at a time, then that's different.
So you've got a group of all these different people, each one essentially being a human instrument without playing an instrument. You are the instrument.
Yeah, pero yo lo que hice, aparte de esto, ¿no? Fui a un estudio de grabación.
For instance, like I went into a studio and I was able to record each instrument separately so that I would be able to use all the instruments at the same time along with me in the concert.
And then sing over it.
And then sing over it.
So we'll be hearing some of that too.
Yeah.
So this is all Cuba Next Exit. And of course, that's a sign on the highway on 25, Cuba mm-hmm. Next Exit. A cappella and scat Cuban music. It's a family event on Friday at the James A. Little Theater. That's tomorrow. You can get tickets at the Candyman or at El Farol. You can get tickets at the door as well. For more information, you can call 204-5811. Ramon Calderon and Solar Banner, thank you both for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
And now let's hear some music.
Papague de belgaso, papague de belgaso, la vie est toute moi, oulale opale. Papague de belgaso, papague de belgaso, la vie est toute moi, oulale opale. Papague de belgaso, papague de belgaso, la vie est toute moi, oulale opale. Papague de belgaso, papague de belgaso, la vie est toute moi, oulale opale. Papague de belgaso, papague de belgaso, la vie est toute moi, oulale opale. Papague de belgaso, papague de belgaso, la vie est toute moi, oulale opale.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.